What if there isn't one, but many great filters? Could humans recover from a massive comet hit? What telescope should you get under $1,000? And in Q&A Plus, can the sun capture interstellar objects? All this and more in this question show. It's time for the question show. Your questions, my answers. As always, wherever you are across my channel, if a question pops in your brain, just write it down. I'll gather them up and I will answer them here. All right, let's get into the questions. Infinite Monkey, would civilization have been able to recover had Shoemaker Levy 9 struck Earth? So Shoemaker Levy 9, this was the comet that crashed into Jupiter in 1994, was about 1.5 kilometers across. And when you think about, say, the asteroid that killed the dinosaurs, it was about 10 kilometers across. So an object that is 1 kilometer across or larger is sort of generally considered to be an object that's going to have a global impact. You know, 300 meters and up is going to have influence on a hemisphere, a continental scale. And then below that, you're going to have damage on a regional scale. So it would not wipe out life on Earth. It would probably deliver a catastrophic blow to sort of our modern technological society, but I don't think it would wipe out humanity, but it would be very bad, you know. So be glad that it hit Jupiter, not Earth. Kim Barron, talk about the great filter and how it had to be 100% effective. What if there are multiple filters and there's no way for a civilization to avoid them all? It doesn't need to be one specific filter. The idea about the great filter is that there is, in the past, there were events, things that were very complicated, required some kind of leap of evolution. The formation of the first life form, the formation of multicellular life, going from the oceans to the land, the development of the brain, the development of a technological civilization. There were these discrete steps that you can imagine that there is, like, maybe there's 1,000 planets. And on those 1,000 planets, you know, only 1% of them actually produce a multicellular organism. And then of those that go on to produce multicellular organisms, only 1% goes on to produce intelligence. And so these are filters that they are filtering down the number of life forms at each step. And that if you can kind of go back and identify what all of those important steps were, then you can sort of get a sense of how this sort of the odds narrow all the way to where we are today. But we are at a step in the evolution of humanity and our sort of place in becoming a solar system spanning and eventually a species that's gone on to explore the entire cosmos. And that there are filters you can imagine that may be very well be in our future, that there is the has to develop spaceflight, has to develop spaceflight and be living on 2 planets, has to be able to escape the solar system. Because if we don't, then the sun will consume us all. And so that's the assumption, is that you're going to have all of these different filters. And so, you know, there's kind of 2 possibilities exist if the great filter is correct, right? That if there's a whole bunch of civilizations that were out there and that number has been winnowed down to the point that we don't see anybody out there, one possibility is that the filters are in the past, and that there was, let's say, 10 filters and we have passed them all. And now it's clear skies in front of us, that there are no filters remaining, that there's no reason why we won't naturally proceed to become a galaxy-spanning civilization. That's one possibility. You know, and if there were multiple civilizations out there, then you would expect that there would also be some of them as well. And so the question is, where are they? Because as soon as you become a galaxy-spanning civilization, that means you're kind of everywhere. So the other possibility is that there is either one or multiple great filters, and that those filters are 100% effective, that we may get past the next one, we may get to having a city on Mars, we may get the next one, but we won't make the next one. And nobody's made the last one, that the filter in the end has filtered out every single life form from becoming a galaxy-spanning civilization. And that's why we don't see anybody in the universe, is that everybody tried, right? Life formed on all these worlds, multiple cellular organism evolved in all these worlds, intelligence involved in all these worlds, but less, and then society formed, and then technology, and then space flight, and then solar system spanning civilization, and then, and by that point, everybody got filtered out. And so that's why you can sort of, you can see it as many filters, or you can see it as one filter, that there is one filter in the future of us. Like, obviously we made it so far, but there is the filter out there in front of us that is 100% effective. And we will eventually crash into the filter. And we also, just like all of the other civilizations out there, will fail to colonize the galaxy. So, that idea that there is something waiting for us that's 100% effective is so terrifying, so sort of gothic horror, eldritch horror to me, that I just say, no, we're alone, or we're the first. So there is no filter, and we're about to colonize the galaxy. Robin Stobie, is there a chance that 3i Atlas breaks up like Shoemaker-Levy Comet? I don't think so. Right now, it's already past its perihelion, the closest point of its orbit to the sun. And so if it was going to break up, it would have broken up. Even though it was on the far side of the sun and it lost in the glare of the sun, there's a bunch of spacecraft that are watching the sun. They block the light from the sun and they're able to watch the movement of the comet. And so it hasn't broken up yet. And this is like the danger zone. And now it's out the other side of that. And so, no, I don't think it's going to break up. Magic Game Dev, there are so many fake photos of 3i Atlas. Can you share your favorite sources for real ones or even your favorite pictures? There are a dozen different observatories that have taken images of 3i Atlas, and there have been a bunch of press releases that have been associated with that. So we've gotten images from Webb, we've got images from Hubble, images from the Gemini North Telescope, and then a bunch of other telescopes as well. And so I this is not going to be a very satisfying answer, but it's that you want the ones that are associated with actual research institutions. So you want images that came from observatories. And so then you're like, well, how do you find those? And so the one answer is that you follow lots of different observatory websites and keep track of their news, because they will post new pictures that they've taken as news releases, and they'll like, oh, we've detected this new thing about carbon dioxide in 3i Atlas or whatever. And then another good source is to go to archive, arxiv.org. And this is the preprint location that astronomers post their research. So they will write up a science paper and then they will post it into archive. And there's about 100 research papers that are posted every single day. And there's like a requirement to be able to even post to archive that you have to be part of a legitimate scientific institution. So you can be NASA, a university, a research institution, something that is recognized and certified. And so you can consider that stuff to be fairly trustworthy. But the easy answer is that you just follow Universe Today, which is the website that I publish, because we are very careful and very studious about making sure that the stories that we report on have legitimate sources. And if there's cool new pictures of 3i Atlas, you bet we're going to post them. And then, of course, every time we have more interesting pictures, we're going to talk about them in Space Bites, which we do here on the YouTube channel. So you can replicate the work that I do and go back to the same sources that I do, which is totally legitimate, or you can just wait for me to do all the hard work. It's time to shout out our new patrons of the $5 level and above. John Stokes II, Chris Bell, Kurt Marble, Justin, Robin Anna, Matthew Fuller, Hughes Thompson, Mark Lowendorf, and John McManus. Join our community at patreon.com/universetoday. Gino Monet, Fraser, do you know of any good budget scopes up to 800 euros? That! if you've got, like, there's two options. Like now my opinions about telescopes, after telling you that I don't have opinions, but this is my personal experience. So, at this point, there's kind of two paths that you go with getting a telescope. One is to do observational astronomy, that you just want to look through the eyepiece and look at objects in the night sky. And for that, you want a Dobsonian telescope, a light bucket, something that moves quickly, allows you to point at different objects in the sky, and you can look through them. Because, like, in general, there's about five bright objects that you want to be able to see: the moon, Mars, Venus, Jupiter, Saturn, maybe Neptune and Uranus if you're brave. And you can even do that in light polluted skies. So even if you live in the middle of Manhattan, you can get a Dobsonian telescope and be able to see the rings of Saturn and the moons of Jupiter and things like that. They're so bright. And then the other tool is, if you want to go beyond that and see all of the other stuff that's in the sky, then you want to go with some kind of automated telescope. And the one that's really great right now is the SeaStar. This is the one that costs about $600 and takes really great images of the night sky. I shared a picture of Comet Lemon that I took, 30-second exposure. Like, it's crazy how good this is and how taking a picture looks, you know, you're not seeing it with your eyes, but it still is kind of amazing that you're able to get pictures of these things at all. So in general, you've got to decide, do you want to take pictures of things? If so, go with the SeaStar. Do you want to see stuff with your own eyes? Realizing that if you live, you know, if you're saying Euros, then I'm guessing you live in pretty light polluted skies, then you may want to be careful about trying to get a telescope you can use with your own eyes, because there's a limited number of objects that you can see until you get in the car and go somewhere dark. It's skeptic. How can real science content creators combat the tsunami of AI slop science channels? You can't, right? Like, especially because YouTube is a willing participant, a enthusiastic partner in AI slop. So there's nothing we as creators can do apart from focus on being better, right? That the hope is that someone's going to watch an AI slop channel and they're going to be like, oh, this is all garbage. I'm sick of this. Is there anybody who's like doing good work? And then they'll find a channel like mine or SciShow or PBS Spacetime or Scott Manley or Marcus House or Cool Worlds. You know, like, there's a ton. Smarter Every Day. Like, there's a ton of good science channels. And then they'll understand the ecosystem and they'll stick with them. And so one by one, people will have become so frustrated by the low quality on YouTube that they will switch over to high quality channels. I think we did the 3i Atlas sort of comprehensive 3i Atlas video, and we had a ton of people saying, like, maybe 100 people said, wow, finally, somebody is doing a good science-based coverage of this object and not just the clickbait AI slop. You know, that was great because that's exactly what we were looking to do. We wanted to just blow people away with the level of reporting, the providing the sources, do a good job. And so there's nothing we can do. Like, how could we do it that YouTube is like literally in the YouTube creator studio, it has AI slop dripping from every corner. It is encouraging me to make AI slop. It is making it easier and easier, providing me tools to slop it up, to get sloppy, and that I am specifically resisting incorporating AI into anything that we do, because clearly there's going to be a backlash. And, you know, like for starters, it's garbage. But then also, I think people are going to be looking for legitimate sources. So no, I think you just keep on keeping on and hope that in the end, this is just a fad and it doesn't work out. And if not, then we all get shut down because we can no longer afford to stay afloat. Ed Skeptic, can anyone buy James Webb Telescope time? You can't buy it, but anyone can get time on James Webb. You just have to make the science case that the research you want to do is good. So every year, the steering committee puts out a call for proposals, and then people write up their proposals for what they want to research. And then the steering committee looks through it and allocates time on the telescope. And you don't have to pay. It's just, you can come from any country in the world. It's free to use, and you just have to make the science case that it's going to be better for humanity if, you know, they allocate time on the telescope for what you want. So amateurs have absolutely gotten time on James Webb or collaborated with other researchers, you know, and this is the same case for all of them. Hubble, a lot of the major observatories, You don't pay them to use their observatory. You make the case that the science you're wanting to do is valid. Chris Nelsonells, do interstellar objects lose velocity when passing through the solar system? If so, could there be interstellar objects in orbit around the sun? What's the likelihood of that? So interstellar objects can lose velocity, but only if they have a three-body interaction with some other object. So if they happen to get so close to Jupiter that and its moons that they get their it gets its orbit significantly tweaked. Apart from that, no, the comets enter with a certain velocity and then they fall down the gravity well towards the sun and then they climb out of the gravity well and they exit the solar system with essentially the exact same velocity that they had when they entered the solar system. It's sort of like a momentary speed up and then they come back out and the way they go. But if the comet was moving very slowly compared to the solar system when it fell in, then it would be a lot easier for it to be captured. And there's almost certainly objects that are within the solar system that are captured interstellar objects. You know, there's been a few that have been theorized. So, you know, there's almost certainly some objects that are captured. It's just, we don't know which ones they are yet. But that would be an amazing opportunity, right? Like if we found the one that they could actually do analysis of the chemicals on its surface and realize that it's 9 billion years old. Well, everything else in the solar system is exactly 4.6 billion years old. That would be mind-blowing. It would be revolutionary for us to be able to learn, you know, bring samples back home of this object that was formed in another star system. All right, those are all the questions that we had this episode. Thank you, everyone, who put your questions into the YouTube comments, everybody who joined me for last week's live show. Now, I'm going to be traveling, so the next live show is still at a kind of unknown time and place, but I'm taking all my gear, so I should be able to make that happen from a remote location. So stay tuned for that. Now, I'm going to talk about a way that you can get your question answered guaranteed. But first, I'd like to thank our patrons. Thanks to Abe Kingston, Barely Griffin, Brian Bodie, Caradwin, Chuck Hawkins, Commander Bielok, Cy Nielsen, Dark Finga, Dave Verbaugh, David Giltinen, David Matz, Evan Pro, Greg Feely, James Clark, Jeremy Madden, Jim Burke, Jordan Young, Josh Schultz, Marcel Smits, Michael Purcell, NordSpace, OneStepForAnimals.org, Paul Robach, Renkaidu, Richard Williams, Sean Sargent, Stephen Fowler Munley, Team 49, Telescopes Canada, and Wolfgang Klotz, who support us at the Master of the Universe level, and all our patrons. All your support means the universe to us. So the time that we are releasing this episode of the question show, we just released the patrons question show. And this is a very long episode that we record once a month with my producer, Anton, not that Anton. And we go through all of the questions that the patrons asked for the month. So we put out the call around the 15th of the month, and then the patrons put in all of their questions, and then we cover them all, no matter how long it takes. And so these episodes run kind of 3 to 4 hours long, typically. And they're good because, you know, I think, you know, I get a lot of complaints from people that the questions in the question show are often kind of repetitive, sometimes very introductory questions. But that's because it's sort of like just a general audience, right? People who are still learning about astronomy. But the patrons' questions, they're from a very advanced audience that is following along with the entire narrative of what we've been talking about on Universe Today on the channel and all that all this time. And so the questions are pretty much all new. And many of them require significant research by me and Anton, who has a physics degree, to be able to prepare and be able to give the answers. And so it's a much more kind of in-depth, more complicated question show. And so if that's a thing that you're interested in, we just released the new episode for the month of October, and you can go and download it. And so with this, you do have to be a patron, but even at the $3 level, you can get access to our entire back catalog of episodes. And then around the 15th of the month, so in about a week and a half, 2 weeks from now, I will put out the call for the patrons question show for November. And then we will begin this whole cycle all over again. So if you sort of really enjoy the question show, but now you've got burning questions, you want to kind of guarantee to get them answered, definitely come join our Patreon, go to patreon.com/universetoday. And then at the appointed time, hit me with your question, your zingers. All right, we'll see you next time.